I live in Israel. This season is dedicated to the memory of the 1,400 of my countrymen who were massacred on October 7th and the 240 people that were kidnapped and are being held hostage by the terrorist organization Hamas. Hopefully they will be returned to their families as soon as possible, and hopefully this terrible war will be able to come to a peaceful end very soon. And welcome to minute 33 of season 6 of Move Around Minute, the daily podcast where we take a Capra-esque journey through the 1946 classic It's a Wonderful Life, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again today is Niall McGowan of the Bat Minute. Welcome back to the show, Niall.
Yeah, hot dog, hot diggity dog. It's me. I don't know, Rob, if you come across, because like the term hot dog now has been ruined for me by, so I used to have to look after a lot of kids, and there's the one of the Mickey Mouse's Clubhouse, like a terrible CGI animated thing Disney did like 20 years ago. I don't know if you've ever come across it. Like, it's for really, really little kids. But they have a song in it that goes like hot dog, hot diggity dog, and it's the most annoying thing in the history of the universe. And I found out that it was written by They Might Be Giants, which I feel was like a personal betrayal because I love that band. And then after all this time to find out, like, no, it was them. It was them that drove the earworm into your temple and screwed around until you were brain dead. That was it was them who did it the whole time. So, yeah. Basically, okay. They Might Be Giants forever ruined the term hot dog for me. That's like, and I was reminded of it rewatching the movie when the whole hot dog thing happened again. So
there you go. Now that and I pay, so George Bailey might be a giant. So that's what you're saying.
He's a giant amongst the, I don't know. Again, I was going to demean the people of Bedford Falls by being like a giant amongst the tiny people of Bedford Falls. But it's like, no, they're perfectly nice people. Why is everyone dumping on the rest of the town all the time?
Right. All right. So episode 33 begins with Potter continuing his diatribe and ends with George showing his true self. Mm. So we ended things yesterday with Potter getting a little snippy and not being the nicest about everything. You know, he basically was saying that you know, if you're friends with someone at the Bailey Savings and Loan, then you're going to, you know, you'll easily get a loan. All you have to shoot pool with them and stuff like that. And then he goes, what does that get us? A discontented, lazy rabble. And then today it continues, and he says, instead of a thrifty working class, and all because a few starry-eyed dreamers like Peter Bailey stir them up and fill their heads with a lot of impossible ideas. Now I say... So, I mean, Potter has some pretty interesting stances on things here. You know, he believes as a businessman you know, you can't, you don't need to have dreams. You just have to work, and that's it. You know, I you know, you mentioned yesterday the fact that you know, this movie was a lot of people believe that there are communist undertones here and stuff like that. I mean, this sounds like one of those phrases that they might, you know, might have caught on to and said, okay, you know, maybe that's what they're getting at here. It's just very strange the way that it all is played out. You know, you know, by him saying that, you know, that you don't have to have a thrifty working class. Like the term thrifty basically means someone who has, you know, spends wisely and they don't waste and things like that.
Yeah.
You know, because he mentions about rabble, you know, so I mean, like a rabble is basically, you know, people who are on a low social position or a large, noisy, uncontrolled group, things like that.
Yeah. Like, it's just so inherently classist.
Yes.
It makes me wonder, like, where does Potter, how did he start? Is he a guy who, like, was he born into money? Or has he pulled himself up from his bootstraps? Because you think he would have a bit more of a Even if he's a self-made man, he would have a bit more sort of leniency towards the lower classes of like, well, I've been there, I had aspirations, and look, I made it, kind of thing. But like the fact that he's so dismissive of just like, yeah, everyone beneath me, the poor people, are all rabble. Like that's, they're just, yeah, you know, people just, yeah, I mean, just lazy. Definitely... They're, you know, this guy, it has an inherently like there's people in my position and there's people in their position, and never the twain shall meet kind of vibe. Correct. To him.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I mean, we know that's who Potter is. That's what he does. You know, so it's funny that, you know, the way that he, actually, I don't know if it's funny, but the way that he looks at the townspeople, you know, he wants to run this town, but he still looks at people, he looks down at everybody there. Like, why would you want to be in charge of people that you don't like?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, on the one hand, I understand the idea of someone being power hungry and that they want to be in charge of things and stuff like that. But like, what is the added advantage to them to be in charge of people that they don't want to be around, that they don't care about and stuff like that? It's, you know, maybe it's all just a financial aspect that he's saying, okay, if these people are underlings to me, so I'm going to make more money. You know, I think that's all he doesn't care about the people. He just cares about the financial aspects of it. And you're like, who cares if they all have dreams? You know, we don't need dreams.
He's got the, he just needs a steady supply of like newborn babies that he can suck the souls out of. Like that's why he needs the people there. So he has a steady supply of, you know, souls that he can consume to, replenish his evil essence over time. But he's, No, that's a good. I think it might be sort of a. He just wants the position of power as well. He's just like, well, you know, I could just let these people go about their business, but like, it could potentially, there'd always be the risk of like me ebbing into them in some way. So as long as he's on top, just make sure that my position is secure and everyone else is still beneath me. He just wants that kind of that you know, that throttle hold on the community. Just to have like, and then also can be a thing that you can say to his other, you know, any other. He doesn't strike me as a guy who has any friends, quite frankly. But you never know; he might go to like a rich social club or something, and he can always just have that chomping over a cigar, guffawing over the how much stuff he owns. Basically, is that's what you get out of life when you're at that level of richness and that level of like loneliness. The only thing you've got left is just to say, this is all the stuff I've accumulated. And aren't I great for having just amassed all this?
Right. That's more or less the way it sounds, by the way that he's saying it. So, and then, you know, George interrupts him. And actually, before that, I'm just going to go back into the whole thing. He says, and Peter Bailey stir them up. You know, meaning that people will come to the building and loan, and it's going to give them hope.
Yeah.
You know, and he doesn't want them to have hope. He wants people to be in despair. He feel, you know, he's that person that says, okay, if people are feeling bad about themselves or about what they're doing, then they're going to want me. They're going to need me more. I think that's more or less what he's looking at. And stuff also, like that.
Again, goes into like, how did he get in his position? Because like, is he just the idea that people might come looking for like a leg up or just something to help them out? It's just like it has the kind of attitude like either you have the money already. You have the position. You like saying things like that. Like, oh, you can't work towards this. Like, you just have to either be born into it or that's it. So the idea of like being able to like have hope and try to claw your way up out of poverty is just like, no, that's ridiculous. What a ludicrous concept to, you know, to come to someone who'd be able to put you in a position where you could eventually work your way out of debt and things like that is, yeah, he's really, really kind of showing his true colors here, I think. Well, the fair, I don't think Potter ever hides his true colors. It's probably why he doesn't have any friends.
Right. I mean, that's part of the issue here. You know, everyone is acting and saying, you know, what they truly mean.
Yeah. There's a guy too at like one of the board members. I'm just trying to discern his look here because his positioning is like he's like the first one along. He's like the furthest on the left to kind of balding guy with glasses, although there's two of them right next to each other. The guy not smoking a cigar, but he's got kind of the way he's got his arms folded and he's kind of like he's kind of, it's a very kind of self-cradling kind of like way of carrying himself, and then it kind of has a slight disapproving look at Potter, like the as he's going on this, like, you, I'm just wondering what this, what this extra's.
You're talking about the guy who has his arms folded on both sides.
Yeah. But yeah, it's a very very odd way of folding your arms. Like, yeah. It just seems it feels like a choice. I'm just wondering what was going through the actor's head at that minute. If this guy's supposed to be, like, is he pro Potter, or is he having to kind of silently sit and go, just sit through the diatribe and let's get out of here, or what his deal is? Like, if he's pro Potter, what's happening here with this guy?
Yeah, it makes you wonder that when they were filming this, I mean, we talked about it obviously on Monday. The fact that here we have, you know, these background actors that are all playing the board members here and stuff like that. So, like, how much leeway did they give them in order to decide how they want to respond, you know, to everything that's going on? Because this is basically this whole week so far is a scene between George and Potter. Everyone else is just they're just spectators. You know, so the question here is, okay, you know, what is he, you know, each of them. I mean, you have the guy with the cigar, and then you have the third guy that looks, on the one hand, you know, he's interested in hearing what has to be said, but he doesn't look like he's approving. And then you have the third guy who you just said, which he has his arms folded in a very strange way, basically, you know, like, I don't trust Potter. You know, that type of thing. That's the way he looks. You know, but we'll never know who these people are, because you can't really place any of them. You know, between the way things are going.
Yeah, look at the way things are going the other day. That actor might just be sitting there too, thinking like, I've got to be down at Hopalong Cassidy in like 15 minutes. Like,
that's right. When is this show? Will he get through this? That's right. When will he get through this soliloquy? You know, that's a thing.
It's like, if Lionel Barrymore messes up another goddamn line, and we have to do another take. God damn it.
That's right. And then George, you know, as he's starting to walk out, he turns to him and goes, just a minute. Now, hold on, Mr. Potter. You're right when you say my father was no businessman. I know that. Why he even started this cheap penny ante building and loan, I'll never know. But neither you nor anyone else can say anything about his character, because his whole life was. And then he loses his train of thought for a second, and he goes, why? In the 25 years since here, he and Uncle Billy started this thing, he never once thought of himself. Isn't that right, Uncle Billy? He didn't save enough money to send Harry to school, let alone me. But he did help a few people get out of your slums, Mr. Potter. And what's wrong with that? Why, here, you're all businessmen here. Does it make them better citizens? And doesn't it make them better customers? You said that they, what did you say just a minute ago? They had to wait and save their money before they even thought of a decent home. Wait for what? Until their children grow up and leave them? Until they're so old and broken down that they... Do you know how long it takes a working man to save? And then he gets cut off. I mean, first of all, this is one of the greatest speeches that George gives in the movie. You know, it's such a great... Because it really shows all of us who George Bailey is. George Bailey is a guy who doesn't want to be there, but he is the right guy in the right time. You know, unlike John McClane, who is, you know, never the... He's always in the wrong place at the wrong time. George Bailey is in the right place at the right time, even though he doesn't want to be there. You know, that's what it comes down to.
Die Hard with Jimmy Stewart, like how that would have worked out. Perpetually trying to leave the Nakatomi Plaza, like, oh, wait a minute now. I can't just let these terrorists come in here.
Mm-hmm.
But that's exactly right, though. He is like, even then, like, he still has that kind of attitude. Like, I don't even know why this business is up and running, but I understand it's the right thing to do. Like, he's just like, I don't know why my dad would even have started this, but I understand that it's helping people. And that's the, even if I want nothing to do with it personally, I can't let it go. Like, it's, that's what really differentiates him from everybody else in the room, is that, like, even Uncle Billy, as we'll see, like, in what, 2 minutes time, was kind of quite content to just let it go.
That's right.
George is the only one to be there, like, no, no, if no one else is going to do it.
Then do you think George is defending things because he's doing it for his father? Do you think he's looking at the building and loan and saying, this is my father's legacy, so I don't want to besmirch things and I want to continue it because of my father?
I, I, I think the there's an element of that in there, but I think it's more what they've shown of George earlier in the movie is that, like, all the stuff with Mr. Gower was very much designed to show that he's always up for, like, he's very understanding of people and of trying to help them out in their worst moments. Like, it's an inherent thing he had since childhood, was, like, you know, he could have done in Mr. Gower and gone and, like, you know, got him arrested or, you know, ruined his whole career, all that kind of stuff. But he was like, I understand what's happened with you. And so I'm going to, like, I'm not going to tell anybody that this is, that, you know, so you can go on and have a career and stuff like that. And so I think it's just an inherent thing within George's, the way he understands the town is that, like, if this goes, then everyone's going to be screwed. Right. Like, he's got an inherent thing in his own core being, is that, like, no, I can't just let everyone's livelihoods go to waste and let this guy take over. So even if his father had been, like, his father had just retired and walked away, George would still be like, well, no, I have to. No one else is going to say anything. I'm going to be the one to say it. So I think it's, you know, that's a part of, you know, a morality he learned from his dad. So, you know, it is a testament to him. It's a testament to Pa Bailey in general. But I think he would have done this regardless of it, you know, of whether his dad was dead or not. But yeah, because he's a good egg, that George Bailey, despite his constant, you know, open disdain for the town. Which right. Like, just cut back on that talk a little bit, George. Then I get 100% on board with you.
Right, but what's interesting, you mentioned the fact that if this was a different situation where his father was retiring, so. I mean, obviously, when they structured this script, they had to do it that his father died, because George wouldn't have taken over if his father was retiring. He's taking over because he sees that someone needs to step up, and there's no one else that can step up. And if his father was retiring, it would be something that was planned. This was not planned, even though, again, going back to what we've talked about numerous times this week, they had 3 months to think about this. And you'd think that they would have thought of some sort of interim decision about it, but they didn't, which is a little strange, even if it's that Uncle Billy's going to take care of it.
Yeah, man. Although maybe George is, he's sitting there with the constant terror of Uncle Billy might take over this, and, like, as soon as he does, that's the end of everything, basically.
Yeah, so, completely. I mean, hey, also, he uses some interesting language along the way. You know, he says about penny ante. Right, he completely disparages the building and loan. You know, he's defending his father, but he's not really saying nice things about the building and loan. I mean, he called it a cheap penny ante building and loan, meaning, you know,
that's my beef with him as a character. It's like, yeah, he's a noble guy, he's doing all the right things, but even then, he's just like, why did my dad ever start up this piece of crap anyway? Like, he's got such a dismissive attitude. It's like, again, at the end, he learns the true value of it all and stuff. But it's the one thing holding me back on him being like, oh, what a great guy. He's like, let's just be a bit more polite about things, man. You don't have to be so dismissive about, like, everything. But, you know, it's maybe then some people, that's what makes him a more interesting character, is that he actually doesn't really like any of the things, but he has to do it anyway. But I don't know.
Right. Okay, no, I understand that. You know, just it's funny the way that the whole thing is scripted about it. You know, he calls it a cheap penny ante building and loan. But and then he switches it around and says, but don't besmirch my father's character. His character is what, you know, the qualities that my father had is the reason this building and loan has worked, and the reason that people keep coming back to him.
Yeah. He's
I think that's what it is.
Yeah. I think George, it's part of his development as well, is as, like, he's just the head full of dreams that he has as well, is that, like, so he just sees, like, everything's small time building alone, et cetera, et cetera. Whereas he's so aspirational, everything's got to be big. So it's only at the end then that he sees, like, the small can be big, and et cetera as well. So it is a good setup of character. You know, I'm backtracking on my own points now, but also just have to say too, like, I know we'll be talking probably more about Jimmy Stewart tomorrow, like, it's, we, you know, one of the segments, but He's really, really great in this film. Like, as well as ones going back now, you know, the film's so old and so, like, it's been spoofed and referenced and, you know, all the it's been done to death because it's so famous and stuff. But still, to actually go and watch him as an actor, like, he's really, like, so on top of his game throughout the whole film. Like, it's really, really terrific work he's doing. This scene in particular, and, you know, really is in the later half of the film as well. Yeah, just a little shout out there. Hot take. Jimmy Stewart was a good actor back in the day.
Mm-hmm. For sure. So he mentioned the fact that I don't understand why my father and Uncle Billy started this business 25 years ago. So if this is 1928, so 25 years earlier is 1903.
Mm.
So I decided just to look to see if there's anything interesting. What interesting things happened in 1903? You know, that would be, things that would be fun to mention. I mean, obviously, 1903. We're not going to find that many movies to talk about from back then. There were movies, but they were like, you know, 10-minute movies or stuff like that. You know, all the Georges Méliès stuff. You know, from back then.
Yeah.
So first of all, in 1903, they had the first Tour de France.
Ah.
It was, July 1st to the 19th. Mm. They opened the Taj Mahal Palace Hotel in Bombay. Orville Wright flew an aircraft with a petrol engine.
All things, though, that telling George Bailey this, he'd be like, oh. I never got to France, and I never got to Bombay.
That's right.
Really rubbing it into him, like,
here we go. We're talking about you know, the first flight out of Kitty Hawk. You know, so it was the first documented and successful powered and controlled heavier than air flight. Here's another.
Bedford Falls also voted the worst town in America as well.
Well, again, maybe it was, but, afterwards they were actually able to, open the building and loan, and that must have helped.
That was if Pa Bailey finally saw that in the paper. He's like, that's it. Someone has to do something around here.
Exactly. The very first box of Crayola crayons was made, and they sold them for 5 cents, and they had 8 colors. Do you want to guess what the 8 original colors were?
I'm going to assume it's all primary, so it's going to be like.
Well, there's only 3 primary colors, so.
So you got like, well, red, yellow, blue, green. And so it's 8. So
that's 4. You got half of them so far.
Black. A little bit black in there?
Yes, black white. Is in there. Nope, no white.
No white. Oh, okay. Orange?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay. And two more. Let's go crazy. Purple?
Nope.
Oh, man. That's my favorite color now, I feel, as well. Like, I've been shafted by the Crayola company. They didn't think it was important enough.
You and the Joker. You and the Joker.
Pink? I don't know. Nope. Pink's a big color for crayons even now, nowadays. It's going to go in there. They randomly put chartreuse was in there as well. gray? Gray is worthy of making a crayon out of. But
nope, sorry.
no, gray. Wow. Brown?
Yes, brown.
Brown? Okay, so we got one more.
One more.
Oh my god! Now the heat is on. I'm just trying to remember colors. Like, I see these things all the damn time. it's gonna be staring me right in the face too, without a doubt.
Not necessarily.
Let's go indigo.
No, violet. Violet.
So violet. Close. Wow! Seriously, it was violet.
Yeah.
Holy moly. Yeah, I guess they were just like, throwing in a wild card there out of nowhere. Purple doesn't deserve a mention, but friggin' violet does. Get out of here. I guess they'd be like, oh, it's purple enough. It's close enough to it. Get out of here. They had a whole war between the people going for gray and purple. And they're like, let's try to meet somewhere in the middle. And, it's like, oh, the white. Okay. Makes, oh, but what does that get? Oh, violent. Yeah, there you go. Fine. Get that out there.
Yeah. All right. Wow. So, wow. What else? Harley Davidson, Harley Davidson Motorbike Company is founded.
So now that George Bailey planned to ride his Harley Davidson to go buy me a box of these crayons I've been hearing about, but they only sell them in the five richest countries in Europe.
Yeah. And then the final thing that I have that happened in 1903 was in Chicago, there was a fire in the Iroquois Theater, which killed 600 people.
Oof.
Yeah.
Wow. It's a bit of a dark one to end on, but
yeah. Well, okay. Again, there's now I found six notable people that were actually born in 1903.
You know, oh, nice. Okay.
You want to guess? No, I'm just kidding.
Orson Welles.
No. Hey, you're close. You're coming close on that one. So if you have
Joseph Cotton.
Elliot Ness was born then.
Oh wow. Hey.
Bing Crosby.
Mm-hmm.
Bob Hope.
It's weird now because you always still think of all these people as being so old, and then to hear them like, oh, they're only born then. Like, oh,
well, yeah, but 1903, still, I mean, as of today, we're talking 120 years ago, people were born.
Yeah, it's only 120 years. Come on.
That's right. Lou Gehrig, baseball player. Mm-hmm. George Orwell. So you said Orson Welles is sort of,
Okay. Right.
And then Jerome Horowitz. Do you know who that is?
No.
His stage name was that was his real name, and then his stage name was Curly Howard.
Oh, okay.
Right. One of the Three Stooges, Curly. So he was born there. I found three people who passed away in 1903. One of them was Calamity Jane.
Yeah.
Another one.
Orson Welles' dad. He also died in 1903.
There you go. Roy Bean.
Okay.
And Alois Hitler, which was Adolf Hitler's father.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Died then. And the winner of the Nobel Prize for physics.
His father died. They're like, oh, my Adolf, what a great guy.
There you go.
Just like, oh, anyway.
That's right. And then the winner of the Nobel Prize in physics that year was Pierre and Marie Curie.
Oh, wow. Okay. I think that's like the biggest story of all of them right there. Well, yeah. Obviously, beyond the Crayola. But yeah.
Yes. So.
Oh. Can you edit the wiki to put in Bailey Buildings Unknown founded? just to see if it gets taken down eventually.
Probably. It's probably not worth my time to do that.
Listeners,
because it would mean
to take the time.
That's right. Because for me to keep going back and checking if. When it's taken down, I don't really care.
Yeah.
You know, that type of thing, but it makes sense. Okay, so that's all I have to say about this minute. You have anything else you want to say about the minute?
No. I was just really curious out there. Like, I just want to put a call out to where was Jimmy Stewart's an Indiana guy, right? Indiana's in Philadelphia? Is that
No. Philadelphia's in Pennsylvania.
Okay, well, I'm about to say, oh my God. I'm not from there, so I don't know the geography.
Correct.
But I think he's he's got such a singular voice, that guy. Like, I've been doing the impersonation of him the whole time. So I just really wondered, like, is anyone in that town, did they also sound like Jimmy Stewart, or what the hell is going on there? Because he talks so distinctly. It's like when we did when we covered Batman Returns, we had to talk about Chris Walken. And Chris Walken's got, such a distinct, bizarre way of talking. And you find out, like, oh, no, his father was German and his mother was Scottish. And they grew up in America. Or he grew up in America. I guess that's how you get the Chris Walken voice, like, growing up in that household. But, Jimmy Stewart is like, yeah, he's just a normal guy from a normal town in Indiana. And somehow he sounds like this. So I'm just like... Yeah, I was wondering if his family all sounded like that, or if you go to that town, it's like, no, everybody kind of talks like this. Like, well, what the deal was. So I'm ask your listeners if they can write in somewhere. get back to me on that, because I'm genuinely curious.
Interesting. Okay. All right. And I want to also mention, did you notice Potter's reaction while George is giving his speech?
Well, I did. My final note of the minute is callous yawn.
That's right.
Because
the whole time he looks bored, he's like, okay, get on with it, get on with it. And then right at the end, he just gives this huge yawn.
Yeah. Again, though, he's probably because he's been, well, you know, he is his father's son. So he's like, I thought my days of listening to diatribes like this were over when this guy's when his dad died. But God damn it, there's another one now.
Right. I mean, I think he's saying to himself, how do I cause another Bailey to get a stroke? Yeah.
You think it's a performative yawn? It's like, oh, it's the yawn that got his dad. Like, that really drove him over the edge. So,
yeah.
But yeah, okay, we're getting that within this minute too. You're getting a lot of Mr. Smith energy out of George Bailey here. Like, he's going into Jimmy Stewart, going back into Mr. Smith mode. I'm just like, he's gonna be. The scene was actually originally 12 hours long, and that yawn is coming after everyone else is lying slumped over in their chairs. It's like, oh, but the bill, he's losing his. It's like, God damn it, George, just let the damn building go, would you?
Who knows? And right. So every Wednesday, I have a segment called It's a Wonderful Wednesday.
Yeah.
So the whole idea of It's a Wonderful Wednesday is that in the 77 years since this movie came out, numerous movies and TV shows that have taken on the idea of this movie and try to use it on its own, you know, to show what would happen to characters if they weren't, and stuff like that. And so every week I talk about a different one of them that I've seen. And this time I actually decided to go in a little bit of a different direction. And I still remember this from 1986. Okay, so we're talking 37 years ago. It actually, I can even tell you the exact date of when this... when this was on. This was on December 20th, 1986. So as of this recording, it literally is 37 years ago since, or as of when this show will be dropped, because, you know, this is Christmas week. So it happened on December 20th. It was from Saturday Night Live. That was the only episode that William Shatner was the guest host on. Okay, and one of the skits, I mean, first of all, they have so many memorable skits here. You know, the opening has him playing Oliver North and singing a song about the Iran-Contra affair, which is great. So you can look that up on YouTube and you know, see that song. It's really funny. The most famous skit from this episode is the Trekkie skit, where William Shatner is talking at a Star Trek convention and basically tells everyone to get a life, which is a great one. Again, you can go and check that out. Yeah. But the one that's really...
It's like, he'll go get a wonderful life, though. And that was his redeeming feature at the end.
And then the episode of... The episode pretty much ended with a skit called It's a Wonderful Life. It's the lost ending of It's a Wonderful Life, where basically, you know, it starts off with, you know, they're in the Bailey house and everyone's cheering and he's got all the money. And then Uncle Billy comes in and Uncle Billy goes, oh, I just remembered what happened to the $8,000. And he says, I put it in the newspaper and I gave it to Potter. And then I spoke to my friend at the bank, and Potter deposited $8,000 right after we left. So Potter's the one who stole the money. So they all decide they're going to go to Potter's house and they're going to beat him up. You know, so we see like a lynch mob showing up outside of Potter's house, and Potter starts getting scared, and they come in and they start yelling at him and they start pushing him, and he's in his wheelchair and he falls on the ground, and then they start hitting him with like sticks, and then he stands up and they say to him, they said, wait a second. You know, they could tell that he's been faking the fact that he's in a wheelchair, similar to what we talked about earlier this week. And then Potter is played by John Lovitz, and he goes, now wait a second, I can explain that.
And then I was going to ask, actually, who's playing who? I'm assuming this is Shatner as George Bailey? Or
no, Shatner's actually not in the skit. He introduces the skit.
Oh.
And you have Dana Carvey playing George Bailey. And John Lovitz plays Mr. Potter. And at this point, they start throwing the body, and you can at that point tell that it is a dummy. And they like throw it against the wall, and things fall off the wall and stuff like that. Yeah. It's just really funny. The whole idea that there's some redeeming factor to this whole thing. You know, that they were able to get back at Potter. I mean, that's one of the things that always bothers me about this movie is the fact that Potter gets away with it. I understand as an adult why it makes sense for them to do it that way, because it doesn't matter. You don't need to, you know, the fact that everyone in Bedford Falls saves George Bailey, just like he's been saving them for years, is the point of this movie. It has nothing to do with Potter. You know, the fact that Potter keeps the money or gives it back or they beat him up, it doesn't change the fact that, you know, this movie is about humanity, about being able to help your fellow man, that type of thing. I think that's a great skit. You can find it on YouTube. You can go and watch that skit. It's a 4-minute skit. So, you know, if like me, you watch it at double speed, it takes only 2 minutes to watch, you know.
I don't know if it would be in like more modern films that they would have a scene of like in the middle of like everything at the end. There would be some edits to like, you know, cut to Potter alone in his house or something to emphasize the point. Like, you know, everyone's coming to George, but like no one's there for Potter's literally there by himself with like a little bowl of soup or something. Or if they would have a scene of like him driving through town and then seeing like, oh, what the hell is happening out here? And then like, you know, all these people walking up towards the Bailey household, and then him finding out like what's happening. And I feel nowadays, or particularly like for movies from like the 80s onwards, they would have to throw in a scene like that to kind of emphasize like, oh, the bad guy find out that he kind of lost or whatever. But no, I think that the implication will be like, you know, Potter will find out about it eventually anyway, because it ends up with way over like $25,000 or something been given to him by the end of the movie. So you would allow yourself a little headcanon fan fiction of Potter ironically has a stroke once he finds out about it, and there you go, you know, everything comes full circle.
That's right. All right, great. So, Niall, do you want to tell people where they can find Niall McGowan?
Yeah, well, of the last 2 minutes, I've been plugging Bat-Minute, but I also, me and my co-host do another show called Miami Minutes, wherein we talk about each minute of a craptacular 1987 Kung Fu classic, although it's no Kung Fu, it's Taekwondo, but Taekwondo classic. Miami Connection, which is was lauded as one of the worst movies ever made when it came out, promptly forgot about, and then rediscovered, and it's genuinely, I would say, it's actually genuinely a great movie. Like, me and John have much genuine, non-ironic affection for Miami Connection. It is incompetently made in many, many ways, but there's so much heart and soul to it, and made for nothing by one of the oddest men in existence, YK Kim. And we've been having a great time. One episode comes out a week, and we've been talking about it for over a year now.
Oh wow!
We're still not done yet, every Saturday or Sunday, you can hear me and John talk about Miami Connection and riffing on the ridiculousness of that film and everything going on within its 80s martial arts, you know, biker ninja gang insanity that's been thrown, vomited up on screen. It's also a full-blown musical at times as well. It's amazing. If not listening to the show, I also would just plug Miami Connection as a film in general, which is also available on YouTube, I believe. You can just watch the whole thing in one chunk on there. And so, yeah, every week you get Miami Minutes covering Miami Connection, which is our side hustle, but also great fun.
All right, excellent. And while you're doing that, you can go rate, review, and subscribe to any podcatcher you might be using to listen to the show. Finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on Facebook, you can find me on Twitter, and you can find me on my website, movierobminute.com. So, until tomorrow, hot dog!
Hot dog, hot dog, hot diggity dog.
Truly, truly dear.
Life with its sorrow, life with its tears.